China's second biggest company has signed up for an exchange program from overseas. Internet giant Tencent announced an agreement with the UK government on Wednesday, which will let it bring film, video games, and fashion to its huge domestic audience in China. The company runs the country's biggest social network, WeChat, a one-stop shop for networking, gaming, and online shopping for its billion Chinese users.
The race to crack internet food shopping is a competitive one, and this new high-tech plant, owned by British online supermarket company Ocado, is setting the pace. It claims to be the most advanced system for online shopping on the planet. 600 robots swarm on top of a huge steel grid, selecting items from stacks of containers underneath. Ocado's first-generation warehouses would take several hours to fill an order, but here in Andover, the average 50-item shopping list is picked within a matter of minutes.
Amazon on Wednesday announced experience centers in 15 urban areas across the United States in partnership with the largest U.S. home builder, Lennar. The thinking is to have customers of Amazon be able to see what a true smart home would feel like, to literally have the entire home outfitted with Alexa in every way possible.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Thursday. It's May 10th, and it's 5:10 in the morning. Another business day getting underway, and we're happy you're here for another edition of The Opening Bell. Today on the broadcast, as oil prices shoot higher, we're going to have some advice for you on how to make the most at the pump. Mike Quincy will be here from Consumer Reports, an automotive specialist there. We'll give you some tips on what you might be able to do to save a little money as gas prices start to go up. And in a minute, it's Thought Leader Thursday. Chuck Garcia is here from Associated Bank, and we'll have a little talk about interest rates and banking policy and even some fintech discussion in there as well. But first, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, Asian markets were moderately higher today, tracking solid overnight gains on Wall Street despite lingering concerns about the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal and trade tensions between Asia and the U.S. In Asia this morning, it looks like the Nikkei is going to end up about a third at 88 points. The Hang Seng is higher by about two-thirds. 273 points higher there this morning. In Europe, markets are generally mixed, with the FTSE lower and the DAX higher. The CAC is lower. And in the United States, futures look to be flat now. Dow futures are up just 5 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures are up just a few points. Oil is at $71.64 a barrel, which is up about 50 cents. A couple of stories we're watching for you. A Chinese tech giant brought to its knees. And delays for imported U.S. cars, apples, lumber, and other agriculture products are early casualties of the widening trade dispute with China and the U.S. A fresh round of talks aimed at resolving the conflict planned for next week in Washington. The battle is already starting to take its toll on both sides. The tech company ZTE said yesterday it is ceasing major operations after the U.S. banned it from doing business with American suppliers as a punishment for illegal exports. Also this week, businesses and officials reported that American products are facing delays in customs clearance because of stepped-up inspections at Chinese ports. Royal Bank of Scotland says it has tentatively agreed to pay $4.9 billion to settle U.S. Justice Department claims that it misled investors over the sale of mortgage-backed securities before the 2008 financial crisis. Settlement marks a watershed moment for RBS, which was bailed out by British taxpayers after a series of acquisitions briefly made it the largest bank in the world before the crisis. The government insisted that the mis-selling claims had to be resolved before it could sell Britain's 72% stake in RBS. It's Thought Leader Thursday, and we're going to have a conversation this morning with Chuck Garcia. He's the Director of Commercial Deposits and Treasury Management at Associated Bank. A conversation that we hope will focus a little bit on interest rates, Fed policy and the economy. Chuck, good morning. Welcome back to the opening bell.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Let's begin with the discussion of interest rates in the economy. The Fed says it's going to raise rates more. I think the betting is it's going to happen in June at the meeting.
Correct.
What are you hearing with your ear to the ground about this? Is this going to be trouble through the year ahead, or how are you viewing it?
Well, I think it depends on which side of the equation you're on. I think overall it's a positive. I think the artificial lows that we sat at for so long, I think, had a dampening effect on so much of certain elements of the economy. So I think it's overall a good thing. I just heard some statistics today that's a given pretty much for June, but September is at 60% likelihood, and I even heard a December was up at 40% this morning. So, you know, what happens, who knows, but I think the likelihood of at least one more after June is highly likely. I think people are seeing. So, you know, in the marketplace today, lot of movement of people's deposits, people's shopping rates. If you pick up the paper, you see, be it consumer or corporate type of rates, are absolutely on the rise. And, you know, ourselves and our competitors already baking those increases in. And so to be able to retain your good customers, you have to be aggressive and try to match the marketplace. So, you know, if you're a net investor, it's a very good thing for you because now your money's actually worth something. If you're on our side of the bank equation, it can be pretty difficult competitively.
Give us a sense of what it is like to be behind the scenes. Would you describe it as frantic, or is it concerning? Or just a lot more action than you've seen in recent years?
Just much more action. I think. We as banks, I think, as rates began to rise, you know, 2 years back now, slowly, there was not a real need to move. Now, with the acceleration of this, there's absolutely a bigger focus, I'd say, in our bank, and I'm sure the same thing is happening to our competitors, that we have to take care of our great clients and make sure we're in front of that with them. So it's a very heightened focus, I'd say, for all of us.
What is the pitch that you give to keep your clients? I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of different things you can't talk about here, but give us a sense of what the pitch is like.
Well, I think trying to be not aggressive, but be proactive. Mm-hmm. So, hey, we anticipate in June a rate increase coming up. And these are obviously for bigger depositors, be they consumers or corporates. Be proactive with them and say, here's what we're anticipating. Why don't we look at this now in anticipation of that? The idea there is you try to get in front of it with your client versus the other guy knocking on the door and saying, hey, by the way, June's coming up. What about this? So it's a very targeted focus that we have for sure.
The other part of what's happening now, we just have gone through earnings season for a lot of the banks. Things healthy at Associated Bank?
They really are. The credit markets from a lending perspective are about as benign as I think we'll ever see them. So you always, you know, there's always that uneasy feeling of, okay, when does this change? It will change. You know, the cycle will change eventually. What sector is it in, and where does that impact either the consumer, corporates, or all of the above? There's always an uneasy element when it's this good. But yes, things are very positive, very competitive in the marketplace. But I think that's going to continue for the long haul.
You've kind of been mentioning the commercial side of this and the corporate side of this from a consumer standpoint. I mean, what do me and you know, Joe Sixpack, how are we going to see what's happening at the bank? How is it impacting us, I guess?
Well, I think you know, back to the rate side, people that are willing to, that have blocks of money and willing to lock in on a CD basis, I wouldn't go too long, my opinion, for what that's worth. But people that are willing to go out for a little bit longer than they would have historically and just let it sit in a money market, there's a good return these days. It actually is material, whereas, again, 2-3 years ago, it didn't matter. So people that have money that they can utilize in an idle fashion, they can actually put to work in a positive way. I think the downside for the consumer is, you know, as rates rise, if you're a borrower, you know, your home equity, your car loan, et cetera, those are going to rise with it. So people that are looking to borrow money on a consumer or, again, corporate basis, that money is getting more expensive too.
I'm curious, as a banker, when you get up and listen to the news in the morning, what is it that you're listening for that could possibly upset this card?
Well, not to get political, but the political element is, you know, it's always a concern. You know, what happened overnight? You know, what are we doing today is always a concern. I think the fundamentals overall in the marketplace, though, appear to be really, really solid. I think companies during the big recession pared themselves down and got lean and mean, and so they're seeing the benefit of that today. I think the one thing that is a question mark, and maybe it is really around the rate side, is a consumer. The consumer has seemed to slow down their overall spending and borrowing a little bit more. I think that could have an overall drag as we look into the summer and beyond. If, you know, we talked a bit ago about oil prices. You know, if gas gets really expensive, that affects the consumer and their willingness and ability to travel, et cetera. So I think the consumer is a little bit of a question mark in my mind.
Yeah, and part of that, the data of over the last week or so, the consumer credit report from the Fed, people were pulling back on their credit cards,
yes,
and that sort of thing.
Yes.
But there were still student loans and a couple of other areas that were still going through the roof.
Yes.
Do you foresee what in the next year? Let's say we have three more rate increases this year. Are we going to be on this pattern of, you know, maybe three a year, three or four a year now going forward?
I would have to say, as we hit the mid level next year, I would have to think we probably would be at a more historic normal level. You know, given the circumstances as they are today, if they don't change dramatically, mm-hmm, I think they'll probably level out about that time. Now, if there are dynamics in the marketplace, there could be an easing again. I don't see past that point a lot of more increases in the Fed rate. I could see more decline if things began to get softer in the economy.
I always remind folks, and you would know this too from a history standpoint, there was a time when we had interest rates that were way, way up there. There's, yes, still being in the single digits is nice.
It truly is. Yeah. Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, you know, I had my awesome 5% passbook account. Yeah. I mean, people would love to have that today.
Right, right. Let's talk about, you mentioned the R word, recession. Mm. Everybody keeps saying we're at the end of this long recovery. But there really is no end in sight to it. What would bring on a recession, do you think?
I think unless there's some dramatic shock, again, probably more geopolitical. Mm-hmm. I think oil is pretty high right now. It's higher than people expected. So that's a bit of a shock, and I think that's had a little bit of a drag. I just, you know, personally don't see a lot of elements or any single elements out that would indicate that would draw on that at this point. Again, as a banker, you're always worried about it and you always think about it. But just you look at the fundamentals of companies, the hiring, the employment level is so full right now. I don't see that as something that near term anyway should be in the cards.
Let's talk about cash management systems. We saw this wonderful article in the Banking Journal about how outsourcing of cash management services has been a thing. Let's talk first about what cash management systems we're talking about.
Sure. Well, I think when you say cash management systems, it can have multiple elements. So if you're a corporate, for example, mm-hmm, some companies ran their own in-house processing for years and years. They found that to be incredibly labor-intensive and capital-intensive, and other organizations first started with banks being better at it and could stay more current with the technology, et cetera. So companies outsource to banks their cash management. And that continues today. There's no doubt about it. The article that you're referencing really is around banks outsourcing their what would be traditional operating cash management type of functions like a cash vault or lockbox, for example. In both of these particular instances, they're very capital intensive. So if you think about building a vault, I'll just pick Associated Bank since that's where I'm at. Mm-hmm. There were points in time we had multiples of these around the organization. Well, they're very expensive to build. They're very expensive to maintain. And then you have the transportation system that's also a part of this. So what happened over the years is most organizations said, gosh, this is too capital intensive and there is a better way. So we outsource and contract with outside providers that's their core business. That's pretty much what they do. Similarly, lockboxes around that too. The labor and capital intensiveness of both of those, as well as maintaining the technology, are just something banks said, you know, there are better options out there. Let's stick to what we're great at, which is gathering deposits and lending, et cetera.
So what are some of those other options? Do you let somebody else come into your organization and run that operation, or do you farm it out completely?
We typically would farm it out. So we will be the front end to the client. Okay, our clients are whom we sell to. We market the provider. We market their services, know what the costs are, know what the feature function is, sell that to our clients. We're the front. They're the back end processing. So if there's a question of service, we want to be the front to that because it's our client. Mm-hmm. We then work with whatever provider we've contracted with. And then, oh, by the way, some banks have outsourced this to other banks. You know, there's correspondent banking services that both we provide and utilize of other institutions. Say, for example, international for us, we work with another institution on that. And then in turn, many of our clients use us for a number of services.
Mm-hmm. I'm hearing that if this is done the right way, clients may not even realize that it's been outsourced.
That's the ideal.
Yeah.
You know, it's called, you know, what we like to say in the industry is a white label. Mm. Okay, so they don't know what the back end brick and mortar is. Ideally, you probably don't want them to. Ultimately, they probably do, but to the degree you can maintain that front, it's a really good equation for banks like us.
And so the idea here is that this sort of frees up personnel and money for you to do something else, to focus on other things. What other things would you focus on?
Well, so in this case, instead of having people staffing in a cash vault, for example, maybe 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, we can put those people out in front of customers and have them more client-facing, maybe provide a better service model, things of that nature.
Would we recognize any of these white label firms that are doing some of this work?
You would. You'd see armored cars like Loomis,
okay.
Brinks,
mm-hmm.
people
okay.
like that. Absolutely. That also is a really, really great support system for ATMs. So, you know, many, many institutions will outsource that to these type of providers like a Loomis or a Brinks or things like that to provide that service.
You mentioned Loomis. I think that's the one I see a lot. Mm-hmm. I've never seen an Associated Bank of armored truck riding around. It's always one of these
actually.
Other companies. Yeah, because that would be news to you.
That would be news. Yes.
Give us a sense too, as we talk about this kind of thing. You mentioned the lockboxes. Would I still come to the bank and be able to use a lockbox at the bank, or does that go someplace else as well?
Yeah, let me differentiate. So you're probably thinking more of a safe deposit.
That's what I am.
Where you have a key and you have your valuables. Yep. Yes, banks still absolutely provide that.
All right.
Lockboxing is you send your payment, let's say your cable bill, if you had a cable. Ah. If any old people like me still have cable, you send your bill in, it's a check, it goes to a third party that is either bank run or an independent for Time Warner or whomever. So that would be the lockboxing there versus a safe deposit. We certainly absolutely still have that.
So one is it's a technical in the air kind
yes.
of thing. I guess I come from part of the world where we call it lockbox instead of safety deposit.
Not uncommon.
Let's change the conversation here a little bit too. And I know we've talked about this before, the fintechs that are out there. There was a good example of a Brazilian bank called Neon. And they've already hit 1 million customers. This is one of these up-and-coming fintechs that's an example of what where we're going.
It is changing so rapidly. I don't immediately know of a, quote, full-service bank that has any significant magnitude at this point in time. But the advent of fintechs in the U.S. and their ability to create and invent and put into market so quickly, so many great things, it's going to continue, and it's changing the landscape entirely.
Is there something, what would be similar to this Neon company in the United States?
I guess you think of lending.com is probably the first thing that would come, you know, Rocket Mortgage, things like that. So they're pretty targeted, so they're not really more of the full service bank that you're talking about here, but that'll happen. It will happen. And I think the recent changes in some of the regulatory arms have indicated they're more open to that today than they would have been, say, 2-3 years ago.
How does a bank like Associated meet up and join up with one of these fintechs? Are you out looking for them now?
I wouldn't say we're out looking for specific ones. Mm-hmm. I think what we say is we have a need. Is there a solution out there that can satisfy that need that we either partner with, purchase their product, joint venture, whatever? Absolutely. I just attended a conference last week where this was a huge piece of the conference, and it's incredible in the last year even how the numbers of them are sprouting up all over, and their ability, again, to to solve really specific problems. And if your institution has a need that needs satisfied, there's probably an answer out there today or going to have an answer.
Before we went in the air, I was talking about this program called Silicon Valley, which is on HBO.
Yeah.
It's kind of mocks the startup world out in Silicon Valley. But I can't imagine the two cultures being any more different. These startup kids that are, you know, riding their scooters into the office and have their pet monkeys with them.
Yes.
And a bank where you figure everybody comes to work in a suit and a tie, but they do have some of the answers that you guys can't come up with.
No doubt about it. And I think one of the things banks have learned over the years, when I think back over time, is trying to bring them into the culture of a financial institution or a bank is just a bad move. You lose all the intellectual yeah. property that you bought in the first place and all the creativity. So allowing these people to do what they're great at and giving them the right environment, I think we've all gotten much smarter about that. I absolutely know that will continue to evolve.
Chuck, always a good conversation. We'll see you next time.
Well, thank you very much.
Chuck Garcia is the Director of Commercial Deposits and Treasury Management at Associated Bank. It's our thought leader conversation. We do it every Thursday here at the Opening Bell. You can listen to our past conversations at WGNradio.com and head over to the Associated Bank at associatedbank.com/thought leadership. You can meet more of our thought leaders and hear more conversations there as well.
Hi, this is Catherine Davis with today's NO Minute on WGN Radio, a rundown of all the Chicago innovation and tech news you need to know, delivered by ChicagoNO.com. Fixer, a new Chicago startup led by Grubhub co-founder Mike Evans, announced it has raised $4 million in funding. Fixer is an on-demand handyman service that sends a professional to your door in under an hour to handle electrical, plumbing, and other household issues. Chicago Parking Meters, which owns the city's meter franchise, launched a new free app that gives drivers suggestions on where they're most likely to find a metered parking space based on 4 years of past parking data. That's today's NO Minute from WGN Radio. Learn more at ChicagoNO.com and sign up for The Beat, our daily email newsletter.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Thursday edition of the Opening Bell. Soaring crude oil prices have lifted national gas prices nearly 21% over the past year. That's according to the AAA. Drivers in nine states are paying at least $3 a gallon for regular gasoline. GasBuddy.com says as of today, the average gas price across the country is about $2.80 per gallon. Mike Quincy's with us this morning. He's an automotive specialist at Consumer Reports, and our conversation is going to focus on how to get the best fuel economy right now. Mike, good morning. Welcome back to the Opening Bell.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, you know, we always hear all of these wives' tales and other sort of myths, I guess, or people say, well, you got to fill up the gas at a certain time of day and you can't drive with your windows down. Are any of these myths or any of these things we hear about gas mileage, getting better gas mileage, actually true?
No, most of them aren't, and that's kind of the beauty of Consumer Reports, because we take these myths and we go out to our 327-acre test track in Connecticut and actually put them to the test. I mean, we drive the cars with the windows down to see if there's an effect on fuel economy. We run the air conditioning during hot days to see how much that affects it. So we kind of take those myths and we put them to the test.
I know that we've had conversations before on this program, and I think we talked to you recently about SUVs and what people are buying. People have these SUVs, and they've been buying them and thinking that gas prices were going to stay low. I bet you that's a rude awakening for some people.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think the American consumer has a very, very short memory. For those of us that grew up in the 70s and 80s, where we saw oil embargoes and oil shortages, there was a real rush to make cars smaller and more fuel efficient. When gas becomes relatively affordable in the United States, people generally buy big. I mean, it's been maybe, you know, 10, 12 years since the last time that fuel prices spiked. And when that happens, you find that there's a line of people waiting to buy, say, a Toyota Prius, whereas right now, Toyota basically can't give Priuses away. But if gas continues to go up, I think you'll see more and more people wanting to get rid of their huge SUVs.
For people who are stuck with their SUVs or a car that guzzles fuel, what has Consumer Reports found about how we can get better fuel mileage, better gas mileage?
Well, really, there's a lot of very simple things that you can do as a car owner to improve your car's fuel economy. The first thing you can do actually is slow down. When you're driving 55 miles an hour and you jump up to 65, you might expect to see a 4 to 8 mile per gallon loss. Jump up to 75 miles per hour, and fuel efficiency can also be hurt by another 5 to 7 miles per gallon. So the faster you go, the more gas you burn.
Is the reverse of that true? If you do a lot of braking, like for instance, driving around the city, does that also hurt gas mileage?
The best way to improve fuel economy with your driving habits is to try to drive smoothly. You know, try to avoid hard acceleration and braking whenever possible. If you're frequently, you know, accelerating really hard and braking really hard, you can reduce your fuel economy by 2 to 3 miles per gallon. So, once you're up to speed on the highway, try to maintain a regular speed. And I guess that's the beauty of cruise control. And as those systems have gotten better, adaptive cruise control, which keeps a steady distance between you and the car in front of you.
I think everybody's been in this sort of scenario where you're running out of gas and you turn off the AC and you open up the windows thinking, well, that's going to get me to the gas station at the corner. Any truth to this AC myth?
Well, in general, when you're running the AC, especially on a hot day, it'll eat up more gas. I mean, they say, well, run the AC or the windows open. The windows open in Consumer Reports testing, we didn't find any measurable difference in fuel economy. But really, if it's hot out, you got a hot Chicago summer coming up. You don't want the driver to be uncomfortable. If you're hot, you're more fatigued. If you're driving on the highway with the windows open, there's all that wind buffeting, and that also will kind of tire you out. So keep the driver happy. Put the windows up. Run the AC. It'll be worth the 1 to 4 mile per gallon hit that you might see.
Yeah, and Mike, I maybe it's just me and my older age, but having the windows open, it's very loud driving around the city of Chicago. It's probably going to hurt my hearing if I do that regularly.
That will fatigue, especially on a long drive. If you're hearing, you're getting buffeted all around, you're going to get tired more, and a tired driver means that you're not as quick to respond to emergencies and whatnot.
Here's one that kind of goes along with the summer season. A lot of us are going to go camping and maybe even take our bike with us places. What have you found about having a bike rack or luggage rack on the car?
Whenever you're putting anything on the outside of your car, you're really affecting the car's aerodynamics, and the engine has to work really hard to overcome that aerodynamic drag. When you even put an empty bike rack on a basic sedan, you might see your fuel economy drop by 5 miles per gallon. When you add like two bikes on the rack, in Consumer Reports testing, we found that fuel economy dropped by another 15 miles per gallon. So, listen, I'm a big biker. I love to camp. I love to do all that stuff. But when you're driving around without all this equipment, then take the racks off, which is also true in terms of car top carriers. You see these Thule, it's kind of like an expanded trunk on top of people's roofs, and that might hit your fuel economy by another 5 miles per gallon. And also, just as the expression goes, you try to take the junk out of your trunk. If you can make your car lighter, that will improve fuel economy. If you're driving around with a few boxes full of National Geographic magazines, say, you know, I'm going to drop it off at the library one of these days. But, you know, weeks, months go by, and you're still driving around with all that extra weight in your trunk. That will also hurt your fuel economy.
My grandfather always told me, if you change the oil in your car, change the oil filter, and keep your tires at regular pressure, you'll have a car forever. Do any of those things impact gas mileage?
Well, certainly, just in terms of overall maintenance for your car, you always have to be changing your oil. Consumer Reports did a test on air filters, and we ran our normal acceleration and fuel economy test with a dirty air filter. We actually didn't find that that fuel economy was affected by a dirty air filter, but acceleration was restricted a little bit. But actually, in modern cars, the engine's computer automatically compensates for this restricted airflow by reducing the fuel use to the engine. So the cars have a way of compensating compensating for when you're not maintaining your car. But I'm really glad you brought up tires. Tires are a major cause for poor fuel economy if they're underinflated. You want to make sure you get the proper inflation in your tires. If you're wondering where to find, people often look on the sidewall of their tire and they see maximum PSI, and that's actually the wrong place to look for it. There's a little placard usually in the inside door jamb of the driver's door that tells you the proper inflation, and that's what you definitely want to be checking at least once a month.
Mike, every once in a while when I pull up at the gas pump, I think, well, am I going to put premium gas in or just regular gas? And then I see the price of premium is generally $100 more per gallon than regular. Does it make any difference what kind of gas you put in your car?
It only if your car requires it, and that's really the key word here. Is sometimes your car's owner's manual will say, for maximum performance, premium is recommended. But in Consumer Reports testing, we didn't find any advantage to using premium when your car didn't require it. So if your car doesn't require premium, definitely put in regular. If it says a premium is required, we would play it safe and use the correct octane because that's what the engine was designed for. But don't buy into any of the oil companies saying, hey, if you put premium in your tank when you don't need it, everything will be better, because we just have not found that to be true.
And finally, I think we've all played roulette with the light. The low fuel warning light comes on. This just happened to me recently where I thought, well, how quickly can I get to the gas station? When the light comes on or the warning sound goes off, well, how long do we have until we're running up? We're out of gas completely.
Usually, a low fuel warning light is an indication that your car has probably between 1 and 2 gallons of gas left in it, and this is always a cause for marital strife in many people's households, because you're driving and your wife or whatever will say, the fuel light's like, yeah, I can make it. Well, don't push it too hard, because it's certainly an indication that you're running low on fuel. For me, usually when it's dipping below a quarter tank, that's usually when I'm going to start looking for a gas station. But it's a risky game you play when you're driving for a long time with the fuel light on.
Mike, great conversation. It's always nice hearing from you, and come back again, please.
Thanks so much for having me on.
All right, Mike Quincy, automotive specialist at Consumer Reports, and we're going to link out to the most recent information from Consumer Reports in the podcast of The Opening Bell a little bit later on this morning.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, Dow futures off about 9 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures are up just a few points each. Now, agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. A lot of evening up in the grain market yesterday, getting ready for today's monthly report from USDA on production and supply-demand issues. That's sent July wheat down 3¾ cents, and July corn down 3/4, and July soybeans ended the day down 4 cents a bushel. Turning to livestock, concerns over wholesale beef prices and a looming supply buildup had impact on the cattle market again yesterday, with June cattle down 62 cents at $105.67 a hundredweight. Grocers resisted paying more for beef at wholesale after prices rose for 6 straight sessions, fueled by improved spring grilling weather in the Midwest, according to traders and analysts. And in the hog market yesterday, lean hog contracts finished moderately lower, profit-taking, and the June lean hog contract ended up 27 cents, $76.57 a hundredweight. You have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Thursday, May 10th, the Labor Department releases April's Consumer Price Index today. Freddie Mac reports on the weekly mortgage rates, and the Treasury Department releases its federal budget. Looking ahead to tomorrow, the University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Survey. Just some of the things that could move the markets today.